Osho, The Perfect Master, Volume 1, Talks on Sufi Stories, Discourse Number 8, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. What exactly do you mean by conscious ignorance? Is it the recognition that one is ultimately fundamentally ignorant, or is there more to it? Asoka, conscious ignorance is not ignorance at all. It is the ultimate state of consciousness. How it can be ignorant? It is pure knowing. Of course, there is no knowledge. Hence, it is called ignorance. But there is knowing, utter knowing, transparency. No knowledge is gathered, but all is known. Conscious ignorance means innocence and conscious. If innocence is unconscious, sooner or later it will be corrupted by knowledge. Unconscious mind is always ready to be corrupted, polluted, distracted. Consciousness means centering, awareness. You cannot be distracted. You remain in your knowing, but you don't accumulate knowledge. Knowledge is always of the past. Knowing is in the present, is of the present. Like a mirror, the mirror reflects if something comes before it, but when it passes, the mirror is empty again. This is conscious ignorance. Not that the mirror does not reflect. It reflects, but it doesn't gather. It is not like a photoplate. A photoplate becomes knowledgeable. The moment something is reflected in it, it catches hold of it. It becomes attached to it. The mirror remains unattached, available, open, vulnerable, unprotected, with no defense, yet always virgin. This is virginity, when nothing corrupts you. Things come and pass. You ask me, what exactly do you mean by conscious ignorance? It is consciousness, knowing consciousness. Ignorant, I am calling it, because it cannot claim any knowledge. That's why. It cannot say, I know. When the Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, who are you? He simply said, I don't know. This is conscious ignorance. Wu misunderstood him. He thought, then what is the point? If you even don't know who you are, then what is the difference between me and you? I also don't know who I am. Wu is simply ignorant. Bodhidharma is consciously ignorant. And that word consciousness makes all the difference. All the difference that is there in the world. It transforms the whole quality of ignorance. Ignorance becomes luminous. It is full of light. Not full of knowledge, but full of light. You ask, is it the recognition that one is ultimately, fundamentally ignorant? No. One is not. So how can one be fundamentally and ultimately ignorant? To think that one is, you have already gathered knowledge. You have already claimed. You have already declared to the world that I am. Those who know, they know something totally different. They know that I am not. God is. They know that my existence is arbitrary. That my existence is a make. That I, as a separate entity, has never existed. I am just a wave in the ocean. But when the wave is rising and reaching to the clouds, it can believe that I am. And the ocean, meanwhile, is laughing and roaring and knows that this wave has gone crazy. Soon the wave will disappear in the ocean again. Even when it is there, it is not separate from the ocean. You cannot separate a wave from the ocean. Can you exist even for a single moment without the universe surrounding you? Not for a single moment. So who you are? What you are? Is it the recognition that one is ultimately, fundamentally ignorant? No. The conscious ignorance knows that one is not. There is utter silence inside. Nobody has ever been there. You have dreamed about it. It is your dream. You are nothing but a construct of your dreaming mind. And secondly, ignorance does not mean that one is ignorant. It simply means that life is ultimately mysterious. The emphasis is not on your ignorance. Remember it. Because the ego is very cunning. It can survive even on the idea of ignorance. It can say, I am ignorant. Fundamentally, ultimately, I am ignorant. But I am. First, it was claiming its existence through knowledge. That my knowledge is valid. That nobody else's knowledge is valid. Now it claims no knowledge is valid. I am ignorant, but I am. Now behind ignorance the I is hiding again. It has taken another face, a new mask, a new persona. But it is the old game being played with new rules. The form has changed, but the content is the same dream, the same stupid dream, the same arbitrary ego claiming absoluteness about itself. No, when I say ignorance, my emphasis is never on I. My emphasis is on the ultimate mysteriousness of existence. Ignorance is ultimate because existence cannot be reduced to knowledge. It is irreducible. It is a mystery and remains a mystery. You cannot demystify it. In fact, the more you try to demystify it, it becomes more and more mysterious. It gathers new dimensions of mysteries. Just watch 5,000 years of human mind's evolution. Has it helped in any way to demystify existence? Existence has become far more mysterious than it has ever been before. Go back 5,000 years. There was a limited number of stars, because by the bare naked eye you cannot count more than 3,000 stars in the night. When the night is dark and full of stars, and there are no clouds, at the most you can count 3,000 stars, not more than that, by bare naked eye. How many stars there? Now they say, we have counted 3,000 billion stars. We used to see only 3,000. Now there are 3,000 billion stars. And this is not the end. This is just the beginning of the counting. The existence goes on and on. There seems to be no possibility that it will be ending somewhere. When the Vedic mystics looked at the sky, it was mysterious. When you look at the sky, it is far more mysterious. Vedic mystics will feel jealous of you, but you don't look at the sky. For thousands of years, man had believed that life, existence, consists of matter. Now physicists say there is no matter. All is energy. They have not been able to solve the mystery of matter. The mystery has become very deep. Now there is no matter. It is all energy. And what is energy? Now even to define it is becoming difficult. Because it was possible to define it in contrast with matter. Now there is no matter. How to define it? Definition is lost. It is there in its seer memory. And the efforts that have been done to define it have made it even look more mysterious. If you go into modern physics, you will be surprised. Mystics look not so mysterious now, with all God and heaven and angels and souls. Even then they don't look so mysterious. The modern world of physics is far more mysterious, incomprehensibly mysterious. And the infinite space. And Albert Einstein says, it goes on expanding. Into what? And he says, we don't know yet into what. But one thing is certain, it goes on expanding. Existence is expanding. Into what? Naturally the question arises. There must be some space beyond it. But that cannot be said by the very definition of existence, that is prohibited. Because when we say existence, we mean all that is, space included. All that is. Then how it expands? Into what? There is nothing left outside it. It is almost as mysterious as one day you go to the market and you keep yourself in your own pocket. Is it possible to keep yourself in your own pocket? It should be. If existence can expand without there being anything to expand, all space is in its pocket, and it goes on expanding into its own pocket. Looks at others. Zen koans are nothing compared to it. Albert Einstein says the world is finite. That too is mysterious. If the world is finite, then there must be something to define it. There must be a boundary. If you call it finite, then there must be a boundary to it. But to make a boundary, you will have to accept something beyond the boundary. Otherwise, the boundary cannot be drawn. The boundary can be drawn only between two things. You can have a fence around your house because of neighbors. If there is no neighbor, nothing exists beyond your fence. How you are going to put the fence where? And you will decide that this is the place where we should put the fence. That this part belongs to me and there is nothing outside it. But Albert Einstein says this is how it is. We can't explain it, but this is how it is. The world is finite and yet there is no boundary to it. Unbounded finiteness. Absurd, illogical. And not only that, this unbounded finiteness is round in shape. Because everything is round. How can an unbounded thing be round? Who will give it the shape of roundness? The mystery has thickened every day. And Albert Einstein is just on the threshold of existence. It is maddening. So when I say conscious ignorance, I don't mean that you are ignorant. I mean that life is so vast and existence so infinite that there is no way to fathom it. You cannot measure it. It is immeasurable. What exactly do you mean by conscious ignorance? Is it the recognition that one is ultimately, fundamentally ignorant, or is there more to it? If there is not more to it, then the mystery is solved. There is always more to it, and there will always be more to it. Whatsoever can be said will never be satisfactory. There will always remain more to it. And I am not saying that what is not said and you understand inside, that is enough. Even that is not enough. Nothing is enough. That is the meaning. When I say existence is mysterious, it simply cannot be understood. To see this point makes one feel humble. To see this point, to let it sink in your heart, one feels like bowing down. To bow down before this mystery that is unfathomable, not only unknown but unknowable, is prayer. The second question, I remember, I let go, I forget, I let go. My love affair with life keeps deepening. Still, I am not without doubts. But the plunge forward, a dance unpredictable, and I allow all around dissolve in throw sound. Ah, Bhagwan, thank you. A question on polarities. Man, woman, Zen, Sufi, can anyone being composite all? Yes, Kavita, I am compassing it all, so can you. Because being is vast, being is neither male nor female. Bodies are male and female. Psychologies are male and female, but not being. Being is simply being. At the very core of your existence, there is no man, no woman. The consciousness is beyond polarity. When you will be witnessing your body, if you are a man, you will see a man's body there as an object. If you are a woman, you will see a woman's body as an object. But the witness, is the witness man or woman? The witness is neither. The witness is simply there. A witness, that's all. A consciousness, a awareness. That awareness comprehends all. When you become a witness, when you become a Buddha, all is comprehended. Then there is no question of polarities. The world is not just polar. That is the meaning of the Christian idea of Trinity and the Hindu concept of Trimurti. The world is not divided in two. The world is divided in three. The three is very fundamental. The two is on the surface and the third is at the center. Man, woman, on the surface. Zen Sufi, on the surface. But as you move deeper, as you dive deep into your being and you reach at the center, all disappears. One simply is a kind of purity, a pure existence. Kavita, it is possible. Not only possible, it has to be made possible. That's my work here. On the path, be a Sufi or a Zen. When you reach at the center, forget all about it. When the goal is reached, the path has to be forgotten. These are divisions of the path. One can climb up a mountain from many sides, can choose different routes. And when you are moving on different routes, you look as if you are moving in different directions, sometimes opposite also. One is going to north, another is going to south. But ultimately, when you will reach to the peak, you would have come to the same place. Peak Buddha is Christ. Christ is Krishna. Krishna is Muhammad. Muhammad is Zarathustra. Zarathustra is Laos. At the peak, all distinctions dissolve. So Kavita, right now, be Zen, be Sufi. And when you have reached to the peak, be Zenufi. Then forget all about. But on the path, one has to move on some path. And all paths are good because they all lead to the same goal. All doors are good because they lead to the same shrine. You say, I remember, I let go, I forget, I let go, my love affair with life keeps deepening, still I am not without doubts. Don't be worried about it. Doubts are perfectly natural on the path. If you are without doubts, that means you have reached on the peak. They disappear only on the peak. They have a certain purpose. They goad you. They keep you going. Doubts are not necessarily hindrances. It depends on you. How you use your doubts. They can become hindrances. If because of doubt, you simply stop moving, you say, unless my doubt is dissolved, I am not going to move, then the doubt has become a rock. But if you say, the doubt is there, but in spite of the doubt, I am going to move, because that is the only way to resolve it. Unless I reach higher, I cannot resolve this doubt. A better vision from a height will help. Doubts are not resolved if you remain clinging to the same space where you are, because those doubts are created by that state of mind. Remain clinging to that state, the doubts will persist. They will become stronger every day. Doubts are not resolved by somebody else answering you. These are not philosophical doubts. These are existential doubts. They are resolved only by experiencing. When you move a little higher, they disappear. You have reached to another state of mind. In that state of mind, they cannot exist. Suddenly they disappear, as if they have never been there. In spite of the doubt, one has to go on moving. In fact, one has to use the doubt as a goading to move. Listen to the doubt and tell to the doubt, okay, I will remember you. But the only way to solve you is, I should go a little higher in my consciousness. I should become a little more alert. It is my unalertness that is creating you. It is my unconsciousness that is creating you, that is feeding you, nursing you. It is my state of mechanicalness that is the cause of it. If you try to solve your doubts where you are, you can gather many, many answers from many, many sources. They will make you knowledgeable, but not really. They will fill you with information. But the doubt will remain somewhere. On the surface, you may start pretending that you know, but you will know that you don't know. And it will gnaw at your heart. You can learn the answers. You can start telling those answers to others. But your very existence, your very lifestyle will show that you don't know. That is the difference between the Eastern and the Western philosophy. They should not be called by the same name, because their approach is so basically different, so fundamentally different, so diametrically opposite. The Western philosopher thinks, but never changes his state of awareness. He thinks where he is. He thinks hard. He thinks very logically. He tries in every way to solve the problem. And he finds many solutions. But those solutions don't help his life. If they don't even help his life, how they can help somebody else's life? For example, the English thinker and philosopher David Hume arrived to the same conclusion as Gautam Buddha. Exactly the same. Had he been in the East, he would have become a Buddha. But unfortunately, he was in the West, in the very thick of the Western newest sphere. He arrived at the same conclusion, but not by changing his consciousness, but by only logical argumentation. Buddha became enlightened. Hume remained unenlightened. Buddha arrived to a state of bliss. Hume remained crawling on the earth in the same way as of old. Buddha created a new tradition, has remained alive even today. 25 centuries have passed. Many people have bloomed because of Buddha. What Hume created? Hume also created great argumentation. And even today, books are written on Hume, and the argument continues. But it is only argumentation. Not a single human being has been transformed by it. And the irony is that the conclusion is exactly the same. Buddha came to see that there is no self. That was his realization. He meditated. He went deeper and deeper into his being. He searched inside each nook and corner, and he didn't find anybody there. That was his release. The ego disappears, and with the ego all its miseries and hells. The ego was not found. So all the problems that were created by the ego evaporated. When the source evaporated, all byproducts evaporated on their own account. When the ego was not found, there was silence. And that silence is beatitude. And that silence is benediction. When the ego was not found, there was all light, radiant. The whole existence flowed in. Buddha became a void, capable to contain the whole existence. He himself became transformed, and thousands of other people became transformed from his insight. Remember, it was an insight. What happened to David Hume? He also came to the same point, but it was not an insight, it was an outlook. Remember these two words. Literally, they are significant. Insight, outlook. He arrived to the same conclusion as an outlook. He discussed, argued, pondered, thought, contemplated, concentrated, did everything on the problem, but never went in. And he came to the point exactly the same, at least in appearance the same, that there is no self. The self cannot exist. But it was not a great revolution in his life. It was just a beautiful conclusion in his treatise. But he remained the same man before the conclusion and after the conclusion. There was not a bit of difference in the man. He continued to behave in the same way. If you had insulted him, he would have become angry, but not Buddha. That is the difference. He would have become angry, although he says there is no self. He would have forgotten all his philosophy. That philosophy was not his insight. He would say that is philosophy, that is aside. Insult me, I am insulted. And I am going to take revenge. You have to be answered. When Buddha was insulted, he smiled. He said, you came a little late. You should have come 10 years before. Then I was there very much. Had you insulted me 10 years before, I would have reacted madly. You come a little late. I feel sorry for you. Because now there is nobody to react. I hear what you are saying, but it simply passes through me. It comes from one ear in and it goes from another ear out. There is nobody inside to catch hold of it. I am sorry. I feel compassion for you. This is the difference between the Eastern and the Western approach. Western philosophy is rightly called philosophy, love of knowledge, love of wisdom. Eastern philosophy has coined a word which I like. He has coined a new word. He calls it philosia. It means love of seeing. Sia means to see. That is exactly the translation of the Eastern term for philosophy, darsana, to see. It is philosia. It is insight. It is seeing in. Western philosophy is a search for knowledge. And Eastern philosophy, or philosia, is a search for knowing. Knowledge looks out. Knowing looks in. Knowledge gathers information. Knowing does not gather anything. It simply goes in to see who is there. Who am I? Its inquiry is not objective. Its inquiry is subjective. Kavita, doubts will persist. They leave you only on the last rung. Never before. Use them creatively. Each doubt has to be transformed into a goading. The doubt simply says you have to go a little further more, a little ahead, little higher. The doubt says, I will not feel satisfied. Whatsoever you have now is not satisfactory. You have to go a little more deeper. Don't be stopped by the doubt. That is not the function of the doubt. And don't start arguing. And don't start thinking. Because by thinking you will become a David Hume. You will remain the same person. My effort here is to create Buddhas. And unless you become a Buddha, doubts will continue. You can solve one doubt, it will assert from the corner. It is the same doubt in a new shape, new form. You repress it here, it props up there. You will get mad. No need. Take note of the doubt, thank the doubt, and say, okay, so I will go a little further so you can be sound. It is like this. A man was sitting on a tree. His friend was sitting underneath the tree. The man on the tree was picking some fruits. And the man underneath the tree was waiting for the fruits and collecting whatsoever were falling. The man on the tree said, I see a bullock cart coming. He was high on the top of the tree. He could see far away. And the man underneath the tree looked to the side where the man was pointing and he said, I doubt, I don't see. There is no bullock cart. What are you talking about? Can you deceive me? I have eyes, I am not blind. There is no bullock cart coming. And the man on the top said, yes, it is coming. And they started arguing. Is the argument going to help? Can the man on the tree convince the man who is not on the tree that the bullock cart is coming? Howsoever clever he is in his arguments, how can he prove to the man who cannot see the bullock cart? What the man did, first he argued, tried in every way that it is coming. It is painted red. One horse is black, one horse is white, this and that, and everything he described. And the man has a beard and all, but it was in vain. Then he recognized the truth, that how can he see? His vision is limited. So he called him, he said, you come up. You climb up the tree and I will show you the bullock cart. Now, if the man underneath the tree says that I will come up only if you convince me that the bullock cart is there, then there is no way. But he climbed up the tree and he saw the bullock cart, and the doubt was resolved and there was no more argumentation. He apologized. He said, I feel sorry. I unnecessarily argued with you. It was not a question of argument. You had a far better vision from here. This is what the Buddhas have been doing down the ages. They say, we have a far better vision from here. From this vantage point, you will be able to see what is. Come closer to us. Don't go on arguing. Not that Buddhas cannot argue. They certainly can argue, and they can argue better than you. But it is pointless. They can silence you through their arguments, but they cannot convince you. They can destroy all your arguments, but even that will not help. You will not be able to see the bullock cart. And the whole point is how to see it. Because only seeing is believing. Kavita, go on climbing on the tree. I am calling you. I can see. You cannot see yet. Doubts will persist. Let those doubts help you to climb up faster, sooner. Let it become an urgency. Those doubts make it an urgency. Doubts themselves are not wrong. It all depends how you use them. They can become blessings. The third question, how is anxiety related to desire? It seems easier to see that one is desiring than to see that one is anxieting. In fact, there is no verb form for anxiety, at least not in English. Am I desiring my anxiety or anxieting my desire? The desire is nothing but an escape from the state of anxiety. Desires don't create anxiety, as ordinarily is believed. Anxiety creates desire. Man is anxiety. Just the other day I was telling you, animals have no anxiety because they don't have to become. They are. A dog is a dog and a tiger is a tiger. And there is no problem. The tiger is not trying to become a tiger. He is. He already is. There is no becoming involved. In the world of the animals, there is no anxiety. In the world of Buddhas, again, there is no anxiety. They have arrived. They have become. They are siddhas. They are beings. Now there is no goal left. No movement. Journey is complete. They have arrived home. Hence the similarity in the eyes of the animals and the eyes of Buddhas. The same silence, the same innocence, the same depth, the same purity. Yet the difference is also great. Animals are unconscious, Buddhas are conscious. Hence, animals' eyes are innocence, but not luminous. There is no anxiety, but there is no celebration either. There is no despair, but no ecstasy either. In the eyes of the Buddhas, you will not find anxiety. You will not find agony. You will not find the constant urge to be this, to be that. The fever of becoming you will not find. But there will be a constant overflowing ecstasy. Peaceful, blissful. A well-being. Between these two is man, half animal, half Buddha. And that is where anxiety exists. Anxiety is this tension. A part of you wants to go back to the animals. It goes on pulling you backwards. It says, come back. It was so beautiful. Where are you going? The other part goes on hoping for the future. In some indirect way, you know perfectly well that to be a Buddha is your destiny. The seed is there. And the seed goes on saying to you, find the soil, right soil, and you will become a Buddha. Don't go back. Go ahead. This tug of war is anxiety. Anxiety is one of the most important words to be understood, because it is not only a word. It is the very situation man finds himself in. This is the human dilemma. The most fundamental dilemma is anxiety. To be or not to be. To be this or to be that. Where to go? Man is stuck on a crossroads. All the possibilities are open. But if you choose one, you have to choose against possibilities. Hence the fear. You may be choosing wrong. If you go to the right, who knows? The path going to the left may have been the right path. And there are people, shopkeepers, who go on calling, hawkers, who go on calling, come to the right. This is the right way. Come to the left. This is the right way. Come our way. This is the only way. Follow Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism. All others are wrong. You will fall in hell. Man is paralyzed, standing on the crossroad, listening to all these people He is paralyzed. Where to go? Whom to listen? Whom to believe? How to be certain that you are going in the right track? Great suspicion, great doubt, great anxiety. And deep inside you, something is pulling you back. That better become an animal again. Fall into drunkenness. Take drugs. Or become a sex maniac. Or become violent. Kill people. Why there is so much violence in the world? The animal past goes on pulling you back. Your humanity is only skin deep. Any moment you can become a wolf, you can become a tiger, you can tear the other into pieces. Any moment. Any moment you can kill. And not only you can kill others, you can kill yourself too. Suicide and murder constantly pulling you. Destruction coming you, alluring you. And then there are Buddhas. Once in a while, you see a man and you are enchanted. He has that enchanted space in him. He has that magic that your future suddenly becomes your present. At least in his presence. At least when you vibrate with him, you forget all your animal past. You start flying like angels in the sky. Those people are also there. This is the anxiety. Where to go? What to do? And whatsoever you do, anxiety will remain. If you become an animal, the Buddha part will go on rebelling against it. Go and do something. The part feels good. But your Buddha part, it starts creating guilt in you. Even the greatest murderer, before he murders anybody, feels the pangs. A great pain arises in him. His Buddha part tries to stop him. What are you doing? He may listen, he may not listen. But he will repent. For years he will repent what he has done. He should not have done it. The thief, before he moves into somebody's house, is again and again warned by the Buddha part. Don't do it. There is still time, escape. If you do it, you feel guilty. If you don't do it, you will feel guilty. Because if you don't do, and you leave, and you come home, then you cannot sleep. Because the animal part goes on saying you are a fool. So much money. And it was so easily available. And there was nobody in the house. And the whole neighborhood was fast asleep. And there was not a single chance of your being caught. You are just utter fool. Why you have come back? There is still time. Go again. If you follow one part, the other part makes you feel guilty. And vice versa. This is anxiety. And this anxiety is very existential. It is not that somebody is suffering it and somebody is not suffering. No, it is existential. Everybody is born into it. Humanity is born into it. Human beings are born into anxiety. That is their challenge. That is the problem they have to solve. That is the problem they have to transcend. Now there are two ways to transcend it. One is the way of the world. You can call it desire. Desire is a way to hide this anxiety. You rush into earning money madly. You become so absorbed in earning money that you forget all existential anxiety. Then there is no point, no time to think about real problems. Then you decide everything and you just go into search for money, more money. And as you get money, more and more desire arises. This desiring of the money or political power is nothing but a cover for your anxiety. That's why people are very much frightened when they are left alone and nothing is there to be done. That's why retired people become very, very uneasy, uncomfortable. They die fast. It is said, now psychological research has proved it, that a man who is retired is going to die 10 years earlier than he would have died if he had remained employed. 10 years earlier, why? Because the anxiety that he has been repressing through his job asserts. He was running after money, chasing after political power. There was no to give to anxiety. Now there is all the time and nothing to do. Sitting in his armchair, he does only one thing, anxiety. Nothing else to do. Now all the repressed anxieties of his whole life, that denied existential part, takes revenge. It kills. He becomes ill. Heart attacks come. He becomes paralyzed. But more possibility is that all is happening because of the psychology, not of the body. When a person is succeeding and his desires are taking him farther and farther away, he remains healthy. Politicians are always almost healthy when they are in power. When they lose power, they suddenly become old. When a person is earning and earning and earning, he remains healthy. When he becomes a failure, when he goes bankrupt, then suddenly, yes, in a single night, all his hairs can turn into white. Literally. Desire is a way to avoid anxiety. But only to avoid. You cannot destroy by desiring. And desire gives you small anxieties, remember, very small anxieties, which are not existential. Of course, when you are earning money, you will have few anxieties. Markets and the share markets and things like that and prices. And you have put so much money. Are you going to out of it or you are going to lose? These are small anxieties. These are nothing compared to the real anxiety. These are tricks to avoid the real. Of course, when you are ambitious for political power, you will have anxieties. 1001 But they are nothing. They are playthings compared to the fundamental anxiety. You ask me, how is anxiety related to desire? Desire is a cover up for anxiety. It is a trick, a strategy. And meditation is to uncover it. That's why people can't sit for a few minutes even silently. Because when they sit silently, anxiety starts raising their heads. They become very much afraid. That's why people ask, even in meditation, what should we do? Can we chant a mantra? Then it is okay. Then mantra becomes your cover. Then you can repeat Rama, Rama, Rama. And you can go on repeating. This repetition keeps your anxiety repressed. Real meditation is Zen, Vipassana. Real meditation is nothing but to sit silently, doing nothing. Just doing nothing, sitting silently. That is real meditation. There is no other technique, no technique at all in it. No mantra has to be repeated. No prayer has to be done. No God's name to be pronounced. You sit, but that is the hardest thing to do in the world. Looks so simple. When I say again and again, sitting silently, doing nothing, and the spring comes, and the grass grows by itself, you think it is very easy. We can sit. And the spring will come and the grass will grow by itself. This is the hardest and the most difficult and the arduous thing in the world. To sit silently doing nothing. And this is the greatest meditation. What is meditation? Just allowing your existence as it is without covering it in any way. So transcendental meditation of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is not meditation at all. It is neither meditation nor transcendental. It is just a strategy to befool people. And America needs such people to befool them. America needs something to cover its anxiety. Because money is there now. So money and the search for money cannot become a cover-up long enough now. Society is affluent. People have all that you can desire. Now what? Now the anxiety is knocking on the doors. And the anxiety is saying, okay, now you have 2-car garage. Now what? Let me come in. Now you have a house in the hills, another house on the beach, a beautiful yacht. What else? Now let me come in. You were telling me, wait, first let me have a house in the hills, another house on the beach. First me let purchase a beautiful yacht. Now you have all that. Now let me come in. I can't wait anymore. Anxiety is knocking on the American doors. It always knocks when a society is rich. When a society is poor, transcendental meditation is not needed. That's why in India nobody bothers about Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Who bothers? People have so many ways to cover up their anxiety so easily. But when all the desires are coming to a completion, what to do? Something new is needed. Then in many directions, new doors have to be opened. Go to the moon. One company is selling tickets for the moon. Of course, it has to be a Japanese company. January 1st. People are purchasing. It is already booked. Tickets are being sold in black. What to do? Let us go to the moon. At least we can cover up with that we have to go to the moon. We can say to the anxiety, wait. First let me go to the moon. Then I will look at you. Wait a little more. Or do transcendental meditation. Any foolish word, repeat it. Call it a mantra. Go on repeating it. That becomes a blanket cover. Real meditation is not a technique. Real meditation is just relaxing, sitting silently, letting it happen, whatsoever it is, allowing the whole anxiety to come up to surface, and watching it, and doing nothing to change it. Witnessing it is real meditation. In that witnessing, your Buddhahood will become more and more powerful. Witnessing is the nourishment for your Buddhahood. And the more your Buddhahood is powerful, less anxiety. The day your Buddhahood is complete, all anxiety is gone. How is anxiety related to desire? It seems easier to see that one is desiring than to see that one is anxiety. Yes, it is easier to see that one is desiring because this is what you are doing. Anxiety is not something that you are doing. You are born in it. It has nothing to do with your doing. You are born as anxiety. That's why it is difficult to see. For one reason. And the second reason, you don't want to look at it. It is scary. One feels that one will go mad. It is better to avoid, to keep it at the back, never to encounter it. It happens every day. One very beautiful man took sannyas few months before. He has been a man. The moment I looked into his eyes, he became afraid of me. I said, what kind of con man you are? Now I am going to con you. I gave him few groups. He escaped without doing those groups. He became so frightened. For months, nothing was heard about him. Then he sent his liar to watch here. A con man is a con man. What is really happening here? Is it okay to get into things? The liar came here. He watched. He must have reported that there is no fear, you can go. He gathered courage and came back. And I told him that you are a coward. What kind of con man you have been? And this time don't try to escape. And I gave him few groups again, and he disappears. Now I have received a letter from Singapore. He says, Bhagwan, I am reading your books here and listening your tapes. But I became so much afraid that you have given me these groups again. And I will have to expose all the rubbish that I am carrying within myself. I will have to expose my whole being. I will have to be nude and true and authentic. And that frightens me. But I will come. I am reading, I am listening, I am gathering courage again. And I will come. It happens to many people. I give them groups, 1 day, 2 days, and they escape from the group. It becomes too much. What fear arises? The fear of exposure. Not that they will be exposed to others. The fear basically is that I will be exposed to myself, that I will have to see what I have been hiding all along. And once you have known it, it will be impossible to hide it again. That's why before I tell you to meditate, I send you into primal therapy, into encounters. I send you into different groups so that the first thing, your cover is taken away. You are left naked, spiritually naked. Then meditation becomes easier. Because meditation is nothing but to be with yourself in your totality. Yes, I understand. To see desire is easy. It seems easier to see that one is desiring than to see that one is anxieting. To see that one is anxieting needs guts. It is really only for those who have courage. In fact, there is no verb form for anxiety, at least not in English. Our languages are as much false as we are. Our languages are made by us. They reflect us. In fact, a real language will not have any nouns, will have only verbs. If it has to be true to life, it can only have verbs, not nouns. When you say this is the tree, you are falsifying. Because there is no static tree anywhere. A tree is a treeing. It is growing. It is constantly moving. A new leaf has come up and the old leaf has fallen. A new bud is opening. When you are saying this is a tree, it is no more the same tree. Your statement is already out of date. This is another tree. When you say this is a river, what do you mean? River is a rivering. It is constantly flowing. And so is a man. And so is a woman. All are processes, dynamic. Everything in existence is a verb. But our languages are as false as we are. They have to be. They are our languages. It is no wonder Buddhas always feel it difficult to say the truth to you, because they have to use your language, and your language is so against truth. Why we use so many nouns when no noun is true? Life is not life but living, and love is not love but loving, and death is not death but dying. Why we use nouns at all? It gives us a feeling of control. Nouns can be controlled. Verbs cannot be controlled. Verbs are beyond. Nouns are static, dead. You can manipulate. Verbs are alive. They will slip out of your fingers. You cannot hold them in your hands. Loving has to be transformed into love. Then it is easy to tackle. If a man says to a woman, I am in a state of loving towards you. Just see how much difference does it make. And when he says, I love you. When he says, I love you, he is saying something static. Implied in it is that tomorrow also I will love. It is a static phenomenon. I love you. It is definite. It is absolute. There is not going to be any change in it. But a man says, I am in a state of loving, you will be afraid. Because a state of loving, it is a process. Morning it may be there, evening it may be gone. Then what? And when somebody says, I love you, the noun is addressed to you. When somebody says, I am in a state of loving, it is not addressed to you. He may be loving to somebody else too. It is dangerous. You cannot. Nouns can be possessed, hoarded. You can become masters. But verbs cannot be possessed. They go on and on. They go beyond you. They go beyond all your comprehension. They remain unpredictable. Nouns are predictable. Verbs are unpredictable. They are like a cloud changing its form every moment. You cannot depend on a cloud's form. There may be an elephant in the clouds. It looks like an elephant. By the time you call your child, come here, come out, there is an elephant in the sky. And by the time the child comes, it is no more elephant. The elephant has dissolved. The cloud is not a fixed phenomenon. Now what to say to the child? He will say, you have been lying. Where is the elephant? In fact, there was no elephant, just the moving cloud was elephanting. Sometimes it is a harassing. It is unpredictable. And we are very much afraid of the unpredictable. And life is unpredictable. So we go on keeping ourselves surrounded by nouns. It feels safe. Our languages reflect our minds, our ignorance, our unconsciousness, our stupidities, our jealousies, our fears, our obsessions, our neurosis. Our language represents all that we are. It is a reflection of our mind. It is a mind product. That's why there is nothing like anxiety. Anxiety, then it is fixed. Then you can label it. This is anxiety. You can label this is love. But if you watch real love, it changes sometimes into hate. Real love changes into hate. Now it will confuse you. So you label differently. This is hate, this is love. And you bypass the link. You never look in the link. Love becomes hate. Hate becomes love. Friends turn into enemies. Enemies turn into friends. Everything is moving into everything else. It is all one. Things are not divided by watertight compartments. The earth becomes the tree. The tree becomes the air. It goes on melting into each other. The air is breathed by you. It becomes your blood. Everything is moving into everything else. Nothing is unrelated. It is all one process. When you stop manipulating life, when you sit silently and simply watch, you will see all this tremendous beauty, this tremendous unpredictable process of life, this dynamism. And this is God. This wholeness, this interdependence, this interlinked existence, where everything is changing into everything else. This fluid energy is God. The last question. Bhagwan, do you ever get bored? Why not drop the ashram and live in the forest? Vidgyan, what you are talking about? What ashram? I am living in the forest. These people are my trees, orange trees, aflame with flowers. Can you find a more wild jungle than this? And how I can be bored with so many beautiful people around me, with such a celebrating existence? If you feel bored, that simply shows you must be insensitive. You must be thick. Your skull has to be broken. Otherwise, where can you find a better existence than this? This is the only existence there is, and the perfect. All is as it should be. Trees are green and roses are red. All is as it should be. How can you get bored? Boredom comes out of insensitivity. B. because you are insensitive, you cannot see the subtle changes that go on happening around you. Hence it looks repetitive. The sun rises every morning, the same sun. How one can remain without being bored? But it is not the same sun. It is constantly changing. It is fire. How can the fire remain the same? Watch fire. It is constantly changing. Flames are changing. It is constant flux. Sun is a liquid fire. It is never the same. But thinking that it is the same, you don't look at the morning. And the clouds are every day new. Their forms are new. They take new colors. Every day they celebrate the coming of the sun. And the birds and the trees and the whole existence, every moment is new and fresh as a dewdrop in the morning. And so are people, but you are dull. You are insensitive. You think it is the same woman you have lived with for 20 years. You have stopped looking at her. You have not looked at her for many years, not into her eyes. You have not touched her. You have forgotten her body smell. Then it is boring. Then it is the same woman again and again. It is not really boring. It is just your eyes have collected much dust. Life becomes boring the more dust you collect in your eyes. The life becomes just formal, a ritual, empty. You go on doing things. Slowly, slowly, all your acts become mechanical, robot-like. Then life is boredom. But I have never seen two moments alike. Each moment has its own beauty. Each moment is only for once. If you miss it, you miss it forever. It will not be repeated again. God is not repetitive. God is very original. He never sings the same song again. If you hear the same song again, then something must be wrong with you. It happened. A woman was singing. It was her birthday. She sang late in the night. Her voice was just horrible. But neighbors were somehow tolerating because it was only once in a year that her birthday used to come. So they had become tolerant about it. But that night she continued and continued. It was getting really late, 2 o'clock in the night. And a man, just in front of her house, could not sleep, tried in every way, tried all tricks, tossed and turned, and did TM and etc. But nothing helped. She was driving him crazy. So he opened his window and shouted at her, "That lady, now it is time. You stop. Otherwise, I will go mad." The woman opened her door and said, "What are you talking about? It is almost 1 hour that I stopped. But what happened to this man? He was already mad. 1 hour before she has stopped. But he was listening. It was something in his mind. It was his inner gramophone. Just watch. When you see a rose flower, your inner gramophone says, you have seen it before. It is the same rose flower. Nothing is special about it. I have seen better. You look at the moon and the inner gramophone says, so what? This is the same moon. And we have seen many times. There are millions of people who never look at the sky. If suddenly one night all the stars disappear, they will not become aware of it. It may take few days for them when the news will come in the newspapers that all the stars have simply disappeared from the world. Then they will look at the sky. And then they will miss. And they will make much fuss and they will say, how unfortunate. And we had not seen the stars for many years and they were here. You are bored because of your inner gramophone. I have none inside me. Each person is fresh. Each moment is fresh. They are not repetition. They are all unique. And I remain thrilled. I remain ecstatic. Your life with Gyan must have become an empty ritual. You must be moving through things, dragging, not even understanding the meaning why you are doing these things. You come home and you kiss your wife. You have to. But there is no kiss. There is no kissing. There is no ecstasy in it. Just a dull phenomenon. And if you feel tired and bored, I can understand. Life slowly becomes so mechanical that it loses all meaning. All meaning oozes out of it. Then it is just a dull ritual. To live this way is to live irreligiously. That's my definition of religion. To live joyously, ecstatically, thrilled by each moment that knocks on your door, is to live religiously. Religion is nothing but the alchemical process in which all your insensitivity dissolves and you become utterly sensitive, delicate, vulnerable. Then each moment is samadhi, is God, is enlightenment. Enough for today.